I do this one again too. This is Michael O'Rourke continuing the interview with Lloyd Barron in his home on July 16th, 1996. So you were about to tell me a little bit about Palmer Torben.
Well, his, of course, he'd been an agent here since about 1939 or 40, somewhere back in there. And his prime concerns was land use and irrigation. And he worked with the earliest irrigators, and he seemed to have a knack on along those lines. He had quite a few programs with irrigation, how to get the best use out of it. He had a, in fact, my son was one of the guys that went around and read meters for him in the summer, and so that they could schedule irrigations so that the farmers wouldn't use too much water, and they would know when to use it, which they didn't in the early days. And they just like that he used too much is not enough. So he had a real interest in that, and he worked with a group of farmers who, well, I guess you'd have to say they were leaders in their field. Henry Haig was a dairyman, and he was the president of the Mayfield Co-op there in Portland, the dairy thing, and of course dairymen needed irrigation, and he didn't have much over where his farm was. So he was very interested in this, and two or three of the other farmers out this way did have irrigation, but only in the wet part of the year. By the time it got dry, they didn't, and they could see where they could do much better. And so they would have meetings periodically. They did for three or four years before they really organized anything. They kind of talked this thing around and kicked it around, and they decided they need to know our congressman back in the time when Walter Norblad was the representative for District 1 is when they started. And Norblad says, I can sympathize with you, but he says, that's too controversial a subject for me to bring to Washington. So he wouldn't help him. And I forgot who the next congressman was, but he did help them, and that was when they really got started. He was willing.
Wendell Wyatt, or was it
Wendell Wyatt
before him?
Wendell Wyatt.
It was Wendell
guy.
Wyatt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was the first one that would really go to bat for them, and of course they'd go back to Washington and sit down with Hatfield and Wendell Wyatt and all of those, and get somebody from the Bureau. Henry Haig was a, I don't think he knew what the word no meant, you know, but he was a pretty good judge of character, and he was a good PR man, and he could kind of bring things together. He had a knack for doing that. And at one time that he wanted to go to Washington to meet with some group, and he couldn't go for some reason. I forgot what it was. And he called up the guy who was the vice chairman. It was old Kurt Ritchie out here at Forest Grove. And Kurt says, I don't want to go back there. He says, I can't do as good a job as you do. Well, Henry says, I've got the tickets for you, and you're leaving at 1 o'clock today. And he left at 1 o'clock today. But that was kind of the way he operated.
Mm-hmm. Now, his brother Oscar worked with him a little bit on this too, is that right?
In the later years. Of course, Oscar didn't, well, he was out of the dairy farm by that time. He just had some land up on the hill. And he made two or three attempts to organize the people to get the water extended up there, but it never worked. He couldn't get enough people to say yes at the right time. And after Henry passed away, why then Oscar, he was a good PR person too, and seemed to run in that family. And so he kind of took over as a chairman of the board for the district. And then he was more active when we tried to get a second phase after the first one was pretty well settled. And we were never able to do it. There's two or three reasons why. One of them was that we had more hurdles to jump through for the second one than we did the first one. You had to make an environmental impact study, and you had to make a social impact study. And the last I knew, the social impact study was a volume about like that, and the environmental impact was probably that thick. And you had to involve so many more people to have their voices felt. And of course, if you had one negative comment, well, that could pretty near queer the whole deal, whether it isn't the majority rule anymore. And you had to be able to prove that, you had to tell them, what's the social impact going to be if you put this dam in? What's it going to do for the local community, for the county, for the state, and for the United States? Well, it's a little hard to build a case for a lake out here at Gaston on what effect it'll have on the United States. But you had to have it, and if you didn't, well, you was done right then. And that was the main place that we kind of fell down. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to make a strong enough case. And then they changed the ratio. You had to show, it seems like you had to be able to increase the value of that water by about three times what you could produce dry or what you could produce with water. Had to be about three times as good. Mm-hmm. So, and some crops you couldn't do that.
Give us another minute here.
Yeah.
9111. Thanks a lot. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
So you needed to show that three times increase in
what? Yeah, and initially it was about 1.5.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say a second phase, this was going to be a dam up near Cherry Grove, is that right?
Well, there were two sites. One was... in fact, there were three. One was above Cherry Grove, and one was down about where the road come in from the south. I forget what the name of that road was, but kind of right at the edge of the dairy that was out there. And then the third one was down pretty close to Gaston, just about where Lyle Gardner's home is out there, went across. And two of them you would flood out, well, in fact, all three of them you would just about flood out Cherry Grove. Mm-hmm. And the people lived up there was raising quite a howl. Later on, some of them come to me and they said, any way we can help you with that, we're ready to get out of there. we'd like to have somebody take that over where we could at least get our money back. So. It's kind of like there was a few of them when phase one, the lake that's up there, when the government was about to buy that out, buy them out, why they had some timber holdings, and they thought, boy, the government isn't going to offer anything for those, so we'll go out and we'll get a private guy to come in here and give us a price, and we'll sell that way. So a couple of them did, and... then when the fellow come around appraising for the the Bureau of Reclamation, why he offered them almost a fourth more than they actually got from this private enterprise. And so then they were trying like everything to buy that back from the guy they'd sold to so they could resell it to the Bureau. They never made it. And they were mad. Of course, they were mad at the Bureau. It was all their fault.
Because they offered too much
yeah,
money.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's human nature.
Right. Well, of course, when they did put in the first dam, it made quite a difference, didn't it, throughout the valley?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not only in the summertime, but also in the wintertime, in terms of the...
And, you know, it's kind of funny, too. When they put in that dam, they were wondering what use they would make of the water, and on sports, why would they let them have motors on their boats and all that, and boy, the people just really raised Cain. They wanted there to do whatever they wanted to do out there. They paid taxes, and they were entitled to do their thing. So I thought, well, you know, there must be a lot of interest. When we were working on trying to get the second phase, I made a whole bunch of flyers and I took them up there and I put them on cars all over the place. And I said, it's rather apparent that you're enjoying yourself here on this lake and you're having a good time. And I said, there is a possibility that we can just double this amount of facility so that you can even enjoy it more. And more people can enjoy it, but we could use your assistance in I forget how I worded it, but anyway, to support a second project. And please give me a call at such and such a place, and we could tell them more about it. Well, out of the 400 and some posters that I distributed, I never got one call. So I don't know whether they enjoyed it as much as I thought they did or not, or they were afraid they were going to get hooked for something, probably.
Now, in terms of the, you'd already mentioned that they took 17,000 acre feet, went to agriculture out of the total of about 50,000, and then there were four cities, I guess, that were in it from the beginning. That was Hillsboro, Forest Grove, Beaverton, and Tigard.
Yeah.
Now, I have a note here, too, that Lake Oswego decided, kind of belatedly, to get in. Can you tell me about that?
Right from the first, they says, hey, if there's more water, we're entitled to it because we're the first user on this river. See, the Oregon Iron Works had a plant down at Lake Oswego, and they initially hired Chinese coolies to hand dig a canal from the Tualatin River across to Lake Oswego, and they would put up boards in the Tualatin in the summer and divert water through their canal over into the lake. And they run this mill, and that was back in 1906, I guess, when they first did that. So they say they had a prior right to it, and that went through the courts, and it was determined that they actually did. So I think they were allocated 17 second feet, and that had to come right off the top before anybody else could use any water. And they didn't have to pay a dime for it. They were just entitled to it. Well, I never quite could see that, but anyway, that's what it was. Well, I guess later then they probably would have bought a little more if they could have gotten it, but that didn't happen. It was pretty well allocated by that time. But I suppose if it had been a phase two, they'd have figured out another reason to want to come in and get part of that.
How much did you say they managed that they got awarded as a result?
Well, I said 17 second feet, but I think it was 57 second feet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, there's always been a little bit of tension maybe between Lake Oswego and the agriculture community out here.
Well, yeah, sort of I think there has been some, yeah. However, once they got their water and all, I think they probably felt a little better about it.
Yeah, well, I think probably the Hag Lake Reservoir really sort of headed off what might have been a real competitive situation with respect to that, to water rights.
Well, it probably did, yeah. Because if they'd have demanded their water and we didn't have the lake, I don't know what we'd have done, because actually there wasn't that much water in the river in the summer.
Mm-hmm. I guess the flows were, well, you already said that they flow backwards as a result of the irrigation.
Yeah.
And there's that, was it Henry Hag that's in that famous picture of where he's straddling the river?
Well, he's one of them out there. No, it was J.B. Putnam who was standing straddle the river.
Uh-huh, okay. Now, you'd started a while back to tell me a little bit about Palmer Torvund, and we got off talking about the Hag Reservoir. And
he was an easy fellow to work with and very cooperative. I don't know what else to say about him other than his strong points seemed to be water and land use. In fact, he took several months, I forgot what it was, and went to England to study land use one year and brought back some ideas that he was able to use here and working with he worked with the county and all in their early years of this land, well, even the urban growth boundaries and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that he liked that kind of work and he was pretty good at it and understood it pretty well. So, and I never felt he really got enough credit for what he did. And, of course, Hag, the lake was named after him, and I don't object to that. Henry Hag did a lot of work. However, I think Palmer did a lot more. And Henry wouldn't have been very effective if Palmer hadn't have been there to back him up and give him ideas once in a while and make suggestions and all that kind of stuff. But we did, and I don't know what's happened to it. When they, here about 2 years ago, I guess, the Bureau supposedly gave the county some money to make a park out on the west end of the lake. And because there are sites out there that was intended to be parks, but they never had the funds to do it with. So I went to bat to get that one named after the park system out on the west end. They're named after Torvund. And I was told that it was going to be. And I don't know whatever happened to the money that was supposed to have been allocated, which would have been summer before last. But as far as I know, there's no park there yet, but they still say that that's what they're going to do.
Uh-huh. So if they do build the park, it'll be Palmer Torvund Park.
That's supposedly what's to happen, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get it done?
Mm-hmm.
Got your firewood split, huh?
Yeah, the last root was a real dilly. It didn't have any grain that went any which way, but it wasn't everywhere.
Huh. Oh.
Hmm. You know, farmers, I guess, my picture of them is that they're a fairly independent lot. And
well, this is true, and that's probably why they are farmers, because they just want to do things their own way.
Right. So it must be quite a task if you're working as, county extension agent to try to get everybody on board on something.
It is, yeah, it definitely is. They've all got a different way of viewing it, and it ought to be done their way or it isn't right. So the best way I've found over the years is you get something you think ought to be done, you just kind of throw it out a time or two and maybe make some comments about it. And all, and pretty quick, one or two of the leaders will say, "Hey, we ought to be doing this and this and this." And then it's their idea, and then they're all for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the leader out here does it, all the neighbors around him will look over the fence. Well, George's doing it that way. That must be the right way to do it. So they'll jump in on it then, mm-hmm. and you can get them pretty well in line that way. But don't ever go out and try and just tell them, hey, you guys, shape up or ship out.
that approach isn't going to work.
Not going to work.
What about ideas like land use planning? I mean, you mentioned that Palmer made the trip to England and did some study over there of land use. Is that kind of idea too abstract to sell, or do people see its value if you explain it to them?
The land use is a rather interesting situation. These farmers, they want to get the tax deferral, like while they're farming, they want a farm tax based on what the earning power of the land is, and not based on the highest and best use, like putting an Intel factory on it. And so in most cases they do have that, but it was set up so that if and when they sell it, well, then they've got to pick up the taxes as they would have been for the highest and best use for the past 5 years, or the last 5 years. That way, they aren't getting everything. You see, they can't just go ahead and say, "Well, I want this tax deferral," and then they get that, and then pretty quickly they sell it, and then they've made whatever that tax deferral amounted to on top of the price of the land. But most of them want to keep it in farmland as long as they want to farm, but then when they want to quit, well, they want to be able to sell it not as farmland, but for the highest bidder they can get, so because that's their retirement. And in a way, I can see that. In another way, it's pretty hard to say that ought to be that way. A person that owns a store building downtown, I don't think he can get an extra big price for it just because he wants to retire. He's still going to take what it's worth as a commercial entity. And that probably is the way the farm ought to be, but that isn't the way they want it. They want to be able to no holds barred when they get ready to sell. And it's hard for them to understand that. So you do have that struggle going on all the time. And I don't know what the real answer is. Then you hear the people in town, well, we want open space. They should maintain that farmland. I like to look at it. Well, that's really no excuse to keep it either. Not to the farmer, it may be to the city person. So, and I think they're starting to do some of that in some areas. They're figuring out a way to buy that land and keep it in open space forever. But they rent it back to the guy that wants to farm it at a fair farming rental price. And it's probably going to have to be done something like that, mm-hmm. to make it fair to everybody. So we haven't solved all the problems yet.
So when you're talking about the state or some entity buying the land and then leasing it back?
Yeah, and maybe it'll just be the public. Maybe the public around in Washington County ought to buy 10,000 acres of open space and rent it back to whoever wants to farm. I don't know who ought to be the people to do that, but somewhere there ought to be some way to handle it. And I presume that the people most logical to do it are the people that are going to benefit from it. Mm-hmm. So that would mean then, if the people of Washington County want to look at farm land, open space, and cattle grazing and all that, instead of just all high rises, why, they're going to have to help pay the bill for it.
Mm-hmm. So pick up the land at the going rate, and then presumably take a bit of a loss on it when they rent it back for farmland.
Well, they may not take a loss. It may rent for enough to pay its way, but they won't make any money on it either. It'll mm-hmm. just be there to look at mm-hmm. and enjoy, I guess. Depends on how much you're willing to pay for something like that, I guess.
Yeah. What do you think farmers think about the urban growth boundary? How do they feel about that? I mean, that's not an issue that sounds like it's close to this one.
Depends on which ones you talk to. I was talking to a couple of guys the other morning that are just barely outside the growth boundary, and they'd like to see it held fast because they want to keep on farming. They're young. Now, if they were ready to sell, I suppose they would wish that they'd do away with it.
Uh-huh, right.
But that's where we don't have the answer figured out yet. No one does that I'm aware of. But I think they need to work on it. And I understand there is a bill now talked about in the Oregon legislature that would maybe give a little common sense to some approach. I don't know what the approach is. But I heard one fellow talking about it the other day, and he says we should look into it and see if it's something that would be good or whether it wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, back just for a moment to the Hague Lake project. You said that once Wendell Wyatt got involved in it, then things started to take form and it moved forward. Were there any stumbling blocks that you recall on the way to getting that approved?
There was a lot of them. Of course, one of the big ones was that we just barely got started on this, Tualatin Phase 1, and the Soil and Water Conservation District. They found that through their program, I don't know exactly what bureau it was back in Washington, decided that they could use certain funds they had for building a project. And so they hired a guy and started signing up farmers, and they were going to build a dam up here on Rock Creek, I guess that's why the Portland Community College went where it is, because of the prospect of a lake right there. And they'd be right on the lake. And finally, of course, this group would talk to the people in Washington, and the people from the Hague Lake group would talk to them in Washington, and finally the people back in Washington said, hey, you guys out there, get your act together. Which one of those projects do you want? You can't have them both. There's a lot of other areas in the United States that wants a water project, and we're not going to support both of them. And so you got to make up your mind, or we're going to not do anything. You can forget it. So then they had some, I don't know just what all went on here, but I suspect guys like Henry Hague stood up and told a few people off. Their project was going first, and it was going to benefit a whole lot more people, and had other aspects of it than just the agricultural water, and so that was the one.
Excuse me.
And anyway, that's what happened. Then the one up there died out, and so they got rid of that. But it was kind of touch and go there for probably a year or so. And mm-hmm. I'm sure it held up this project for a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest one that had. And of course, then the other thing was getting the farmers to make up their mind that if they wanted water, they're going to have to pay for it. You see, before, if you could get your nozzle in the creek or in the river, well, you just drew out what you wanted. It didn't cost you anything. And now, to put their nozzle in the river, it was going to cost them money.
Uh-huh. Hold on, just one.
So there, it took quite a little education to make them come around to the point where they were willing to pay for water that they'd always gotten free previously.
Uh-huh.
So I'd say those two things were probably the two biggest hurdles that they had to get over.
And I imagine that's why some of the areas stayed out, too. They didn't want to have to
pay. I'm sure that's right. I had a guy out here, bless his soul, he's passed away now, but he changed his acreage four times. He'd come in and, he'd only sign up 5 acres. He would try that water thing. He didn't know if it was going to work for him or not. Well, I said, when they design those pipes to go out in an area, they're going to design it just for the water that's signed up in that area. And there's going to be no chance for you to change your mind later on unless somebody else served by that same line decides they don't want it. That's not likely that anybody's going to want to not irrigate once they start. So then, he says, I can see the point, all right. And so then he signed up the whole farm, which was, 120 acres or so. And then a little later he come in and, no, he says, even if I'm irrigating, I won't be irrigating all of it. So then I'm going to want to cut that back. And so he did. And then later on he wanted to add some more. He just could not make up his mind. He didn't want to buy anything that he wasn't going to have to pay for. He wasn't going to be able to use.
Right. Didn't want to pay for anything.
And at one time, you wasn't able, if you had a chunk of ground like this, and you decided that you wanted to irrigate this 40 acres, you signed up for that 40, then you, another year, decided, no, you'd like to put that water over here, you couldn't do it. It was signed for this 40, and you couldn't put it on this 40 or this 40. But now they've got that changed around so that you can switch water on the same ownership as long as it can be reached from the same pipe. Mm-hmm. And so there was some things had to be worked out, but they have been pretty well. Mm-hmm. But it was a new experience for everyone here, and I think they have worked through it quite well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's one more point here in my outline, although I think I would like to come back and talk to you a little bit more in some other time. But just one more story that maybe you can tell us today, and that was that you mentioned that there was talk at one point of pumping effluent from the Trojan.
Matter of fact, when phase one was studied, they studied all the streams around. They talked about, in fact, there's figures on it, out of Gales Creek, Scoggins Creek, Tualatin River, Derry Creek, Nehalem River, and pumping it over the hill out of Trojan. And after it was all said and done, about 2 years of study, they decided that, they kind of prioritized them, and this was the top priority. Was Scoggins Creek, and then I forget now, I think maybe the main stem of the Tualatin was second choice. But anyway, they had those all figured out, and they decided, I'm not sure what all the decision was relative to the Trojan plant water, but I know at one time they were talking about, that'd be warm water and it just has a valley full of steam, clouds from that water. And they didn't think they wanted that. And then somebody else was afraid there was going to be some atomic waste in it.
Radioactivity or something.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be good for the area. So, make a long story short, they settled on the Scoggins Creek.
So they were thinking that, the water, I guess, that cools the Trojan plant must be drawn from the Columbia, so it would have, in effect, been a water transfer from the Columbia over the hill into.
Yeah, and I guess that didn't set too well with some people, so they decided to keep it on their side of the hill and we'd keep ours over here. And the fact that we, in several of these streams, we had enough water throughout the year if we could hold it till the time of year when we needed it. Now, Gales Creek flows a lot of water. I guess there wasn't, well, two things. One is there wasn't as good a site for the dam as there was over on the, where it was placed. And the other thing, a lot of that is gravelly over there, and they'd had to spend a lot more for the anchoring of the dam and the foundations than they have where they are. Mm-hmm. So all in all, why that's the way it worked out. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure the Bureau of Reclamation still has all that data, and also, excuse me, priority of which streams were which. I mean, which were preferred. In a second phase, we took what I think was their second choice, which was the Tualatin, and that's where it would have been had we been able to put it across.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's some of us that would like to have seen this happen. There's not many state parks in this part of the state. And still well over half the population lives within 50 miles of this location. And I would like to have seen, we have Henry Hague Lake on the Scoggins Creek, about a mile over the hump is the Tualatin River, and that would made another lake about the same size from the standpoint of water storage. And then to make a state park of the land between them, extending back into the Coast Range as far as needed. I think that'd have made a terrific recreation site, and we could have had just about any kind of recreation that you can imagine in those locations. There's old, right down toward this end of that hump in between, there's old fossil beds, I said his name earlier, I can't think of it. Lyle Gardner took me up there one day and showed me where there was all kinds of clamshell beds and stuff like that on that, and I don't know what else you might find if you looked around. So I think it would have made a good potential state park. But in fact, we had one of the state guys coming up here to look at it and decide and make some decision on it. And then they started having problems of financing the upkeep of parks and all, and the idea kind of fell by the wayside.
Uh-huh.
We were never able to get them here. They promised they'd come two or three different times, and they never did.
Oh, that's too bad. actually, I also meant to ask you earlier when we were talking about that very first Army Corps of Engineer plan to mm-hmm. Straighten out the Tualatin and move the water on through. That was, I guess, a somewhat serious plan at one point. How was that plan stopped, or did they drop it without much fuss?
Well, I think, and that of course was before my time in the county, and all I know is what I've heard. And I never did really inquire into it too much, but I think the landowners along the site raised such a furor that they just dropped it.
Just backed away from it.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. The only other thing I was going to ask you about was in terms of the construction of the Hague Lake Reservoir. I guess was the city of Hillsboro in on that? They were in on that from the beginning, I assume. Is that?
Yes. Once they signed up before this construction was started.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they had a far-sighted city manager here, an old Barney. And he had set the stage for a good supply of water. They had a little reservoir up on the upper Trask, and they run that down into the Tualatin, and then they picked it out of the Tualatin and used it. And he said, well, we've got all the water that we're ever going to need. Well, of course, they didn't ever figure that Hillsboro was going to get the 50,000 population, which they tell me it's going to be before the end of this year. And so they could see the way the population was going and the things were developing, that maybe that wasn't going to be enough. So the cheapest way for them to get more was to buy into the Scoggin project. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did. Well, now they're raising the dam up there, and they're making a 20,000-acre-foot storage, and what was a 4,000-acre-foot
storage. Right, I heard a little bit about that.
So they're kind of, fortunately, they had a site they could do it. And then if they have to go beyond that, well, then I don't know what they'll do. They'll be hoping for the phase two, probably.
Uh-huh.
But that's a little bit of the history on that.
And you said that city manager Barney, what?
Jim Barney.
Jim Barney, right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
And he was the manager ahead of
Eldon Mills.
Eldon Mills, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Eldon Mills continued to be involved in water issues.
Well, he did. In fact, he is yet.
Yeah, he's
a little different aspect. But he was dead set against any more water for a number of years. But he was finally the one that led him into the buying a share of the Hague Lake water. Because by that time, well, I suspect his city council people kind of convinced him that maybe he'd need to take a second look at that.
Mm-hmm. So he was not in favor of it then? Initially.
Not to begin with, no.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, if you felt that your city had all the water they need, well, why spend money for more?
Right, yeah, that's right. That makes sense.
yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, it's getting on towards 4 o'clock. I probably should head back into town.
Yeah, but I've got to put on a Kiwanis program tonight for their dinner meeting, so I guess I'm going to need to get thinking about that pretty quick.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been a great interview, and well, maybe we can figure out another time where we could continue.
Well, after you kind of work on that, if you think there's anything I might be able to add to, a lot of gaps in my knowledge, that's for sure.
Well, that's okay. We're going to get the as complete a picture as we can by talking to a lot of different folks. Thank you very much.
I did serve as secretary of the board for 3 years while Palmer Torben was out of the area. And then I don't suppose I had a lot to do with it, but he did it soon after I had quite a conversation with him. And when they got to the point where they need a full-time manager, I told him, Palmer, you're the guy that probably mainly responsible for this project being here. You ought to be the manager. You know more about it than anybody else. Well, maybe he would think about it. And we talked about an hour and a half one night after some meeting we'd been to. And it wasn't too long then until he got out of the Extension Service and become manager of the project. So I don't know if that had any influence on him or not.
the manager of the Hague Lake project.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Lloyd.
Okay.